Troubling news coming out of the Baker Correctional Institution. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, we speak with TU reporter Ben Konark about his investigation into the way visitors are treated at the Baker County Prison. What are your thoughts and questions about this? You can get on the line right now at 549-2937. Then later, a conversation with legendary Disney animator Floyd Norman. Find out about his appearance in town. Plus, The Spectator later in the hour with some ideas for your weekend. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, a disturbing new report from the Florida Times Union. Female visitors to the Baker Correctional Institution in Sanderson, Florida, say they're increasingly being strip-searched when they go to the prison to visit friends or family. Corrections officials in Tallahassee recently mandated a crackdown on visitors to try to reduce the amount of contraband entering prisons. But an investigation by the Times Union finds the crackdown isn't really producing much of a success in the way of turning up contraband, and that prisoners are still far more likely to get their contraband from staff and guards at the facility rather than their visitors. So why are these strip searches continuing, particularly of female visitors? And are they a violation of the rights of people who have committed no crime and are just visitors to the prison to see loved ones? With more on this, we welcome reporter Ben Konark of the Florida Times Union. He wrote the story now live on Jacksonville.com. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
And here's our question to callers. What are your questions about strip searches at Florida prisons? Do you find this troubling? We want to know what you think. Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax. And we welcome your comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. And so you began investigating this because, Ben, you'd heard stories of women going to the Baker facility near Jacksonville and being asked to basically take their clothes off.
Yeah.
What are you finding here? How did this all begin, by the way? How did you start down this road of investigating this?
Sure. So this is actually a great example of why it's good to engage with your readers. I heard about this from a reader who actually followed me on Twitter. She had been following some of my reporting on the police here and reached out to me. I actually forgot how we ended up talking on the phone. I think, you know, I got her number somehow and we were talking, and she was telling me about long lines at Baker and how the lines were long because everyone was getting strip searched. So that's really all I had to go off of. I kind of locked it away, and I had been doing other reporting on other things over the summer. And then a couple weeks later, I returned to her and said, hey, let's talk more about this. And as a reporter, I'm always trying to figure out what kind of documentation exists that I could prove that this is happening. Because, you know, just showing up at the prison and trying to observe it isn't going to get you very far. So I asked her about that, and she said, well, actually, we're all signing these forms. So I put in a request to the Florida Department of Corrections for all of the consent forms. And that took about 2.5 months, and it came back with almost 200 of them.
Hmm. And 97% of the people coming into the prison to be strip searched are women. Why is that?
Yeah. So 97% of that first 3 month period of the initiative. So that was the only period we were able to get consent forms for. And then after that, there's been 158, I believe, I'm going off memory here. But we don't have consent forms for that. So we can't tell you how many of the post-October searches were women. But the first 3 months, it was 97%, so 180 women and 5 males. And I say males because, and I should probably say females, because we don't know the age of all these people. Some of them might be kids.
It's 549-2937 to join the show. And the reason for this, the Florida Department of Corrections says they've cracked down on conditions where they let people come into the prisons because they want to confiscate contraband.
Right.
They said what we're dealing with at the Florida prison system is an understaffed and violent set of institutions.
Right.
So conditions are bad. Let's just be really clear about that.
Absolutely.
Really, really bad.
Yep.
At the state's correctional facilities. That's been investigated over and over again. This is a way the corrections department is saying to reduce the flow of contraband coming into inmates. What type of contraband are they worried about coming into the system from visitors?
Well, there's actually a breakdown, and I could try to pull it up when we get a moment, but there is a breakdown of the kind of contraband they see inside the prisons. And a lot of it is cell phones, a lot of it is drugs. Synthetic marijuana, also known as K2, is a huge problem. There, for whatever reason, I guess because it doesn't show up on drug tests, so the inmates feel more able to use that. That's been a huge issue for them. But when we started reporting on this, you know, that was a given. We knew that there were contraband issues. We knew that there were violence issues, and we knew that these two things played into each other. But what we didn't know was we had heard from a lot of people who had worked in prisons. You know, guards and staff are more likely sources of these kinds of contraband for two reasons. There's not as much scrutiny on them, and they are interacting with these inmates in a way that it's kind of you scratch my back, I scratch yours.
So guards are bringing in contraband because why? Most of these prisons are in rural areas. The prison system is underfunded.
Right.
Guards and staff have a motivation then
right.
to bring in contraband. They're getting money to do it.
Yeah, so think about it this way. So it's a rural area. There aren't that many employment opportunities. And you decide, all right, well, maybe I'll get a job at Baker CI. And then you start there and you're really not getting paid anything. And it's a very dangerous job. And as you're hanging around these inmates, you hear more and more from them, hey, man, I'll give you $500 for a pack of cigarettes. And the more you hear these kinds of things, the more you start to wonder, well, maybe I just smuggle in a few packs of cigarettes, make a bunch of money and leave because this job isn't great anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And we reviewed arrest reports and we also reviewed internal records from the department trying to quantify just how often this happens. And we spoke to one former guard at Baker who spoke to me about her thoughts on how often this happens. And she said basically that, you know, this is a problem with staffing and it's not really attributable to the visitors. So this really bore out in the numbers because we were able to find not only the visitors who had been arrested, but visitors who had been caught and not arrested. And these were for internal department records. So things like they found someone with sunglasses that had a camera in them. They didn't arrest the guy, but these incidents didn't happen very often at all.
So scattered incidents of contraband coming in from visitors, yet you're finding that the strip searches of female visitors continues. Women are asked to take off all their clothes, part of their clothes, just their bra?
Yeah.
Particularly an underwire bra?
So yeah, this is an important point. So the strip search doesn't necessarily mean that you're taking off all your clothes, but it can vary. So I spoke to some women who said, I was just told to lift out my bra and shake it out. And then they patted me down or they ran my fingers underneath where my bra was. Some women had to remove their bra and hand it to a CO while they were patted down. Other women had to take off their shirts. Other women had to take off their pants. So it's really, they do try to isolate where the alarm's coming from. So if it's coming from your lower half, they might make you take off your pants and not your shirt, but it's very rarely is it a full strip search.
Are most of the visitors to this institution women?
We believe so, and we have requested.
I would guess that, but
right.
I'm sure you need to quantify that.
Right, and you know, yesterday when the Florida Department of Corrections put out their press release and basically were saying, you know, you've left these facts out, including several facts that were actually in the article.
And what's the official response from the state to you on this investigation, by the way?
You know, they haven't really pushed back very hard at all. You know, they said that we were misleading and they said we left out facts, but the facts that they said we left out by and large were in the story.
What did they say you left out?
For instance, they said fact, these guards are of the same gender, which was in our story. You know, they've talked about medical implants, which we didn't mention in our story. But I forgot what we were just talking about, but another interesting part that I noticed from looking over who was caught with contraband, it's that a lot of the people who are caught with contraband are caught in their vehicles. So it's not
before
even...
Before they come into the prison.
Yeah, or they're coming in and the canine alerts to their vehicles and they find stuff and they're like their center counsel and stuff.
So doesn't that indicate to you then, though, that they do have a legitimate issue with this?
Well, I guess where I was going with this is that, you know, when you have something in your vehicle, a lot of them are like, well, I forgot that was even in there. So you've seen an increase in canine screening of these cars, and some of this contraband is being found in vehicles. We don't really know if they were going to be attempted to bring this stuff in.
We'll go to your calls in a moment for reporter Ben Konark, his latest investigation, live on jacksonville.com. What are your questions about this investigation into Florida's prison system? It's 549-2937. And as you have reported and other media outlets have reported, Florida's prisons, if you were going to give them a grade, they'd get probably a D or an F. They're violent, they're understaffed, they're in a state of upheaval. There have been demonstrations, riots, inmate deaths at several facilities.
Yeah.
So for you then, Ben, to investigate how they're strip searching visitors coming into the prison.
Right.
That's a window into the larger issue, it sounds like.
Yeah.
About the state of these prisons overall.
Yeah, and I started actually reporting on prisons right when I got here almost 2 years ago. And it was about what they were calling disturbances, which have since been recognized as riots. And I talked to some corrections officers unions, and I've done some research on this. And, you know, basically the problem boils down to money. These systems are starved of money. They don't have enough guards to move the inmates around, so the inmates sit in their cells and get restless. There aren't enough programs to keep these people busy. There aren't educational programs. There are very few work programs, which have come under scrutiny of their own. But what you have is a population of people who are restless, and that makes people more violent. So understaffing and underfunding of these prison systems is definitely at the root of all of this. But the question becomes, what do you do when you have a situation like this? Who do you focus your attention on? And a lot of people who view this critically say, well, this is an easy target, right? You have women who have no idea about this underwire bra thing showing up at the prison. They've driven 2, 3, 5 hours to get there. And then they're suddenly told, well, you have to do a strip search or we're not letting you in. So it's really, it's an enforcement technique that's targeted on people who are kind of the least able to foresee this kind of stuff and play a very, it's worth mentioning, we had to ask for a lot of this data. 2.5% of the contraband in the last 5 years, and this number has, I got it every year for the last 5 years, it has remained pretty much steady.
Okay.
So even as contraband increases by 50%, it's only 2.5% they can say with certainty came from visitors.
You interviewed a number of people who study prison systems and jails. They push back on the idea that these searches are necessary. They call them inherently unreasonable. They raised as an example the TSA. We all go through that. Most of us go through that experience in airports. Most people aren't strip searched when they go through TSA, although sometimes you are made to submit to an X-ray, which is like a virtual strip search.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I know out of all the times I've flown, which has been a lot, I've one time been patted down and it was uncomfortable. But, you know, the thing about the TSA is interesting because there is actually, I got an email from someone yesterday after the story came out saying we've been lobbying to have body scan similar machines that they have at airports at the women's prison. I believe there's one or maybe two women's prisons in the state.
Again, that comes back to money.
Right.
Those cost money, right?
They do cost money.
It's a lot
money.
Less expensive, I guess, to just say, take off your bra, let us pat you down.
Well, there's technology that they're using at these prisons called cell phone detection technology that also costs money. So maybe if you were to come to use some of that money to buy this other equipment, I don't know what the cost difference would be.
Let's go to your calls now for the TU's Ben Konark, his investigation into Florida's prisons and strip searches in Baker County, 549-2937. Wendy is in St. Augustine. Hi, Wendy. Good morning.
Hi, this is Wendy Tatter. I've talked to you before. And
hey, good
nice
morning.
To talk to you.
Good to talk to you again.
I was going to ask a different question, but now that you're talking about the strip searching, I've been through that a zillion times. And the thing that bothers me about it is it's arbitrary, where they're going to decide that your skirt's too short or you can see through it. And it, a lot of times people will be standing in line and they're dressed perfectly fine, and the officer will decide, oh, sorry, you got to go and buy something else to wear. And it's really demeaning. And they started a thing where you have to go into a small room if you go to the bathroom, and then they research you again. It's really strange. But my real question is, and I don't know if you've heard about this, is they're saying that they're going to change the visitation rate for prisoners to only be allowed to go one day a week.
Yeah.
From 9 to 3 on a Saturday or a Sunday decided by the prison.
Yep.
Do you know if that's a true fact?
Yeah, it is. So we are actually going to do another story on this. It's going to run a day after. So the story that came out yesterday is going to run on Sunday. The story is going to run on Monday. And it is true. They are implementing a new visitation schedule. They're going to cut visitation.
And they're saying it's for the safety of the inmate and the families.
Right.
That is absurd.
Yes. So they're saying it's because they don't have enough corrections officers to make this process run smooth.
Wendy, what's your job?
I'm an artist in St. Augustine, but I do talks on prison reform and how to change the mandatory minimum.
I see. Sentencing. That's right. Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, thanks for that call, Wendy. Thanks for that.
Sure.
Oh, thank you for that call. Can women just show up without a bra?
No, that's
why not?
Yeah, so there are strict rules on what women can and can't wear. You have to have a bra.
Why?
I don't know. I don't run a prison, but I don't.
They make you wear a bra to visit an inmate.
There is concern, I know, about.
But you will get wanded with the underwire bra, which most women wear today.
Well, in the past, it was you would get wanded, and you know, before July, you would get wanded. The wand would go off around your bra area. The corrections officer would say, "Oh, it's your bra," and let you through. So what changed in July is that no matter what, you know, you could set off the alarm. They could wand you. It would be, okay, it's your bra. Go in this back room behind this partition here. We're going to ask you to remove your bra.
I just got to come back to this. If you show up without a bra.
Right.
They don't let you in?
That's correct.
I'm sorry. I just.
Yeah.
This is baffling. Like, so, why? What is the rationale behind that?
Well, I think it's important to recognize here, and this is something that one of the professors that I spoke to brought up, is that these are our. Prisons in Florida are spaces dominated by white males. And by and large, these systems have been created by white males. So a lot of things that disproportionately affect women, like the issue we're talking about today,
have been decided by
white males.
Yeah. Here's an email from Fabrizio. Wouldn't the simple solution in this case be to search the guards rather than the visitors?
Yeah, and I do believe that guards go through some level of search upon entry to these facilities, but I do not believe that guards are being strip searched, but I don't actually know that for sure.
Do you think, based on the data you've seen, that would be a smarter solution to this?
Think like a lot of things, you know, a lot of things in the criminal justice system, it's not there's no easy solution. It's about priorities, right? So. How do we view the prison system? What do we want to get out of the prison system? Do we want to focus on rehabilitation or do we want to focus on punishment? And in Florida, we are very focused on a punitive system. For instance, over the summer when there were some demonstrations happening, anyone who spoke out about these demonstrations, this organizing they were trying to do inside the prisons, would get put in solitary confinement. So you have a lot of stifling of natural human wills and behaviors inside these prisons.
What would you say to anyone listening who says, why is this even worth an investigation? If they're in prison, too bad. They need to suck it up, deal with the bad conditions. They did something to deserve being there.
I would say I'm sorry that they feel that way. I believe that everyone should have empathy for fellow human beings, whether they've committed a crime or not.
All right, let's go to Jesse in Argyle. Jesse, you're on the air.
Just one quick question. One being the last, even being the most, how many women actually been caught sneaking in contraband?
Right.
Thanks for that.
So we have this number for the local prison, and we're in the process of trying to answer this statewide. But the local prison, I believe it's been 5 visitors in the last year, and that's of about 10,000 or more people.
Jeff is in Mandarin. Hey, Jeff, good morning
and
to you.
Just to clarify, those weren't okay. all women who were okay. caught, right?
Okay. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, two points. One, Melissa, I worked at a juvenile justice prison system in Duval County, and I'm here to tell you, yes, you absolutely need to wear a bra.
Why is that a rule?
Because of the reaction of the prisoners. Because of the reaction of the
prisoners. I see.
And it's an animal house. Because when you get that many males together, the testosterone levels go through the roof.
And yeah, Well, what do you think about this investigation, Jeff, since you've worked not in the adult, but the juvenile system?
So I'm gonna say this, and I'd like to be able to comment on it as well. I think that the need to inspect the guards is real, and the need to crack down on the guards is real, but that's not a reason not to do the to do contraband control at the front end as well. It's two separate issues in some ways. They're not necessarily related, and the fact that the guards are probably the source of a large part of the contraband, and that makes perfect sense to me. They are underpaid, understaffed, and ill trained, and it doesn't mean that you shouldn't try and do the other thing as well.
Okay.
And then just one last comment, and this is for your reporter as well. A question for your reporter as well. We're phrasing this discussion as if there's an inherent right for people to visit prisoners, and I realize that everybody should have empathy for their fellow human beings, and I do, and I honestly believe that connection is the reason. But from a legal standpoint, do you have a right to visit a prisoner? And that's a legal question that I'm trying to get to.
Thank you for that.
I don't know the answer.
Sure. I don't either. Let's find out. Ben.
Yeah, you do not have a right to visit a prisoner. It's a good point. These are privileges. So I think it goes back to what I was saying about rehabilitation versus punishment, right? So it's been shown time and time again that if you don't allow visitation, especially in-person contact visitation, prisoners who get out of the system are more likely to recidivate and enter the system again.
So it's a pragmatic thing.
Right. You're trying to
allow regular visits.
You're letting people keep their support networks outside the prison. Right.
Right.
Recidivism, it's worth emphasizing this. Recidivism is a huge problem in Florida. I don't know the numbers cold, but I know they're high numbers of people who exit the prisons and go right back in.
They reoffend right away.
And it's a giant waste of taxpayer money.
Chuck at the Beaches. Hello, Chuck.
Hey, guys. Thanks for letting me share. As far as whether or not what kind of clothes you should wear and what you should expect, I would assume that would be very simple to give people instructions. You should be able to go online. You could be able to go on the phone and see whether you should wear a bra with a wire under it. That's a no-brainer. That's really simple. I have an acquaintance who spent a year and a half in that facility, and when he came out, he had to go into drug rehab. That is not good. And for us to have a facility, these types of facilities where you can't have safety, where you can't have people have to be concerned about whether they're going to get hurt or whether they're going to get harmed, and they're not getting rehab, that is unacceptable. And for these people to not be getting counseling and being helped to get back into our community is not good. And as far as me, if I go to that facility, if it will help them to strip search me to make sure that drugs and things are not getting, I don't have a problem with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. All right. So not everyone has a problem with this.
That's true. And I actually, so one thing I wanted to get back to you was this idea of the guards and the visitors being kind of two separate issues, which I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think really the big picture here is we have a recognition that there's a problem. There's a contraband problem, there's a violence problem, and that's both those are very clear in our reporting that these problems exist. The question becomes, how do you deal with these problems? There are difficult and expensive solutions, like adequately funding the prison system, and there's a low-hanging fruit, like putting the onus on people who come to visit their loved ones. So it's a question of priorities, right? So you've then dedicated these resources, these guards, to spending their time strip searching women, the vast majority of whom don't have anything on them, and the vast majority of whom find the whole process very degrading and discouraging. So these women now, who aren't doing anything wrong, feel less inclined to visit their loved ones in prison. And as these support systems erode, recidivism increases. And as recidivism increases, the prison system gets worse. So you're really making
it as a counterproductive approach. And so more investigation on this, meanwhile, coming this weekend, right?
That's correct. Yeah, we have a couple more stories coming out this weekend.
Look for those on Jacksonville.com. Ben Konark of the Florida Times Union, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Much more still ahead later. Some ideas for your weekend from The Spectator. But up next.
When I arrived in the 50s, they were in production on Sleeping Beauty. That was my first Disney feature film.
A conversation with a Disney legend, animator Floyd Norman. Find out about his appearance in town. Back in a moment.
Follow what's happening at WJCT, even when you're away from your radio. Get the latest news, event updates, and see what happens behind the scenes. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
You've seen him on the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. Now join news anchor Hari Srinivasan for an in-depth discussion Thursday, April 19th at the WJCT studios. VIP reception at 6 with a discussion at 7:30. Tickets for the event are $25. To purchase tickets and for more information, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state
about the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
This week on Jazz Night in America, we're celebrating pianist, composer, and radio host Marian McPartland for her centennial. Outtakes from her long-running piano show Piano Jazz and a performance from the 92nd Street Y. Marian McPartland, next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, if you've seen classic films like Sleeping Beauty, The Jungle Book, or the Toy Story movies, you've seen the work of legendary animator Floyd Norman. The 81-year-old Norman became the first African-American animator for Walt Disney Studios way back in 1959. And in the decades since, he has brought many Disney and Pixar classics to life. Everything from Robin Hood to Mulan to more recent films like the Toy Story movies and Monsters, Inc. Norman has also worked on animated TV shows like Fat Albert and the Smurfs. Floyd Norman speaks in Jacksonville March 29th at FSCJ South as part of the Cultural Council ViStar International Artist Lecture Series. I talked with him recently about his iconic status as a trailblazing animator. Take a listen. Floyd Norman, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Of course, you're well known for your incredible work at Disney, the first African-American artist there. But you've done a lot since then, and I know there are going to be a lot of Rapt listeners who come out to see you speak in Jacksonville and learn more about your career. How did all this start for you?
My career began pretty much like most of my colleagues. We fell in love with the cartoon medium when we were children. Most of us like to draw or paint. Some of us like to write or just wanted to be filmmakers. So I fell in love with animated cartoons when I was a kid, and I knew that one day I wanted to work for Walt Disney.
And you realized that dream. You worked on so many amazing films and productions. What are the ones that you are proudest of?
Well, keep in mind that I came to Disney long after the Disney studio had made a number of classic films.
Mm-hmm.
So keep in mind, I grew up, like most kids, I grew up on these Disney classics when I was a child. So when I came to Disney, a lot of the famous Disney films had already been made. When I arrived in the 50s, they were in production on Sleeping Beauty. That was my first Disney feature film back in 1957. So, and there's been a number of films after that, but, you know, it's just continuing this Disney tradition.
Right. Starting in the 50s with Sleeping Beauty, and then classics like The Jungle Book, Robin Hood, Scooby-Doo, Mulan, one of the Toy Story movies, Monsters, Inc., all the way up into the 21st century. What a sweep of a career. And you've watched these amazing technological changes in animation, too. That must have been an interesting journey for you.
Well, yes, animation has been, you know, it's been continually evolving from the 1930s. I like to tell the kids that innovations in animation didn't begin in the 90s. It began in the 1930s because Walt Disney in particular was always pioneering new techniques. Those techniques evolved over the years from, you know, Xerox, the photocopy process that replaced hand inking, then to computer paint systems that replaced painting by hand. And now to the point in the early 90s when animated filmmaking became totally digital with the advent of companies like Pixar Animation Studios that began making animated films using computer technology. So I've watched the business evolve all the way from traditional hand-drawn to the remarkable computer work being done today.
Which, it's got to be interesting for you to go to the movies today and see these incredible technologies telling the stories in a new way. And also, you are the co-founder of a site called AfroKids.com, presenting African-American images to kids. When you started as an animator, right at the dawn of the 1960s, you were the trailblazer. There weren't good representations for people of color in films and on television and in cartoons.
No, there weren't. I never saw myself necessarily as a pioneer. I came into this business not to promote social change. I came in simply because this is what I wanted to do with my life. The fact that I became Disney's first African-American animator was just, that's just the way it worked out. But I didn't come to the studio with any social agenda. I came there simply to tell stories and make movies.
Right. But then, as your career became so renowned, it's interesting to see how you've used your talents to further positive images in the media and in entertainment, particularly for kids. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Yeah, I would say, it's not something I gave any particular thought to at the time when I was just trying to build my career. It wasn't until years later that I realized what I was doing, if that provided positive images for children of color to make kids realize that they could have a career in motion pictures or television, that those dreams could be achieved. So it came about, it wasn't until many years later that I began to look back on my career, or people began to come up to me and tell me how I had inspired them, or they had never considered a career in motion pictures or television until they became aware of me.
Hmm.
So it was rewarding to know that it was not done intentionally, but if my career had inspired other kids to follow my path, then that was all well and good.
I'm sure you inspired quite a few, and there are a lot of amazing talents in the business today, although, of course, we could always do a better job of having diverse representation. Have you seen Black Panther? Did you like that?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. So many great films are being made today. By being at the Walt Disney Studio, I had the opportunity to be there at the studio when those films were being made. Ryan Coogler was was making Black Panther. Ava DuVernay was finishing up Wrinkle in Time. Kendra Barris was producing his TV show, Blackish, mm-hmm. and the spinoff, Grownish. So all of that has been taking place at the Disney studio, and to be there and to see the number of African-American actors, writers, directors, producers, that has been a phenomenal change from the time when I arrived as a kid in the 1950s, when I was the only black face on the Disney studio lot. So I've seen many, many changes over the past 50 or so years.
And when you stepped onto that lot, how were you treated? What was the culture like then for you? And how did Walt Disney interact with you?
Well, keep in mind that when I came to the Disney studio, when all of us came as young kids, we had no interaction with the boss.
Okay. We
were just a bunch of green kids right out of school, so we had no interaction with Walt Disney, at least for a decade. It wasn't until I had already worked at the Disney studio for 10 years that I finally began to work with Walt Disney. But that took a decade before I even was able to climb that ladder.
Hmm.
But I was treated surprisingly well at the Walt Disney Studio. Looking back on the 1950s, I think people would expect a negative experience. For the most part, my experience at the Disney Studio was positive. Not to say that it was perfect, but I think it was far better than most people might imagine. So we were all young artists. We had come from many different backgrounds, ethnicities, from different cultures, from different countries around the world. We came from everywhere, from Paris, France, from Switzerland, from New York, from El Paso, Texas. So myself and my colleagues came from all over the country and all over the world, and we were treated well. We were all young kids. We were there to learn, and the Disney old-timers, the veterans, mentored us as young kids. And we became those who would, follow in their footsteps. So my experience overall was positive. And my experience working for the old man himself, Walt Disney, was also a very positive one.
You called him the old man?
Yes. It's kind of funny. As a young kid back then, I looked at Walt Disney and his colleagues as being old men. Because after all, they were the age of my grandparents. So they were older men and women. So we often referred to Walt Disney as the old man, respectfully, of course, but he was the old maestro. And so, we were learning from these old timers who had made the movies we saw as children. So now today we're the old timers.
Right.
And now we are mentoring a new generation of filmmakers who are going to, hopefully follow in our footsteps.
Well, it sounds as though you enjoy that part of this career path, and it certainly you've inspired a whole new generation of talents. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, and there's so much interest in your talk in Jacksonville. So, thanks for giving us a few minutes, Floyd. We appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
That's legendary animator Floyd Norman, the Vistar International Artist Lecture Series presents a talk with Floyd Norman, Disney's first African-American animator. It's coming up Thursday, March 29th, 6 p.m. at the Wilson Center at the FSCJ South Campus. Well, a local man who's going blind recently saw the beach for one last time. Woody Parker, who is suffering from glaucoma, wanted to get one last glimpse of Fernandina Beach. Wish of a Lifetime, a wish-granting organization for seniors, and Brookdale Senior Living got together to help his dream come true. With his wife Jeannie by his side, he was able to take in all of the sights of the sand and the ocean one last time. Sadly, treatments for Parker's glaucoma have been unsuccessful in stopping the loss of his vision. Glaucoma is a group of eye diseases where damage to the optic nerve leads to progressive vision loss, and it's the second leading cause of blindness in the world, affecting millions of Americans. Despite sad stories like Woody's, new treatments for the disease are showing promise. We just wrapped up World Glaucoma Week to raise awareness about this. Here with more, local retired teacher Carol Matthews, who's being treated for glaucoma. Hey, Carol.
Hi.
Also with us, Dr. Catherine Friedel, a Florida eye specialist. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
And the good news is that Carol's being treated with a new treatment called the MicroPulse laser. It helps people with hard-to-treat glaucoma. Carol, that's you, right? You're someone that needed help for hard-to-treat glaucoma?
I certainly did.
Yeah? And how did the story begin for you?
When I first developed glaucoma, which I assume I inherited from in my family, it was just a matter of taking drops during the day. It wasn't difficult. But then as the disease progressed, I had multiple drops and dozens of surgeries and more and different drops. And finally, we just got to the point where I was out of options.
And that at that point, you made your way to Florida Eye Specialist Doctor. You use a new innovative treatment called the MicroPulse laser. How is it helping Carol's vision?
Well, all of the glaucoma treatments that we have right now are targeted towards lowering the pressure and slowing the progression of disease. Mm-hmm. And we are successful in many patients in lowering the pressure enough that we can slow the progression of disease. Carol has had several glaucoma surgeries already, and there were no great surgical options as far as traditional glaucoma surgeries, but there was a newer laser treatment that could help lower the pressure, and that's the MicroPulse.
And that has worked?
The MicroPulse in Carol has been a very good success. It took 2 minutes of treatment, and she's come off almost all of her drops in the eye that we worked on. She's actually gotten back some vision. She's seen the best she's seen in many years.
How exciting is that for you?
It was wonderful. It was a fairly easy surgery to get over, to recover from. And for me, it was a triple play. It accomplished the goals of our surgery that were to lower the pressure and also pain, which I want to talk about.
You had eye pain.
It got to the point where the pressure would spike at night and it would wake me up with a stabbing pain in my eye. Mm. And at that point, I knew that we needed to accomplish at least that goal during surgery. And the second thing is that it freed me up from the daily disruption in my routine, taking drops. At the beginning and the end of the day, it's fairly easy. But in the middle of the day, it can be disruptive to your schedule. So I got the freedom of my time back during the day. And then thirdly, it reduced the expenses that I have.
So a win-win all the way around.
Hundreds of dollars.
Yeah.
So
that's
great.
Anyone with a family history like Carol's, anyone 60 or older, and people of African, Hispanic, and Asian descent, they're all at higher risk for glaucoma. Doctor, the National Eye Institute projects more glaucoma cases expected over the next couple of decades. So people at risk need to get screened early, right?
If you have a family history of glaucoma, or if you've ever been told that you might have high eye pressure, you need to be seeing a doctor at least once a year to prevent blindness.
Because there's no cure. There can be mitigating treatments like yours, though.
That is correct. We do hope that there will be a cure in the next 5 to 10 years, but as of right now, there's only prevention.
Our sight is precious. So, Carol, I'm so glad you've seen some success with this.
It has been wonderful. Dr. Friedel has just done wonders for me.
I'm so thrilled for you. I'm so thrilled we did this.
It's nice to tell a positive story on this show.
It definitely is. It was a win.
It's World Glaucoma Week. Carol Matthews, enjoying her retirement in St. Augustine with better eyesight. Good to talk to you. Also here with us, Dr. Catherine Friedel, a Florida eye specialist. Ladies, thank you.
Thank you so much.
In a moment, a look ahead to a very interesting event this weekend, A Brush with Nature, and some other ideas for your weekend from The Spectator here on First Coast Connect. We'll be right back.
Community hospice and palliative care. Since 1979, the compassionate guide for more than 200,000 patients facing advanced illness in Northeast Florida. Today, serving 16 counties, including yours, available 24/7 to help you and your loved one. More at choosecommunityhospice.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Highway, hospital, home, work, where negligence causes injury or death makes a difference in the law that applies and in the result. More at waynehogan.law.
A journalist with years of experience in the Middle East goes home to Paris after the 2015 terrorist attacks.
I think the more you're exposed to it, and I think we can see it in Europe now, it's not that familiarity breeds contempt, but it becomes less shocking.
And she writes a novel about surviving the trauma of mass shootings.
It recedes a little bit in the sharpness.
Paris Metro, next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Trump business partnerships in India, where the Trump Organization has entered into more deals than in any other foreign country. We talk with journalist Anjali Kamat, who wrote an article in The New Republic titled Political Corruption and the Art of the Deal, and Andrea Bernstein, the co-host of the podcast Trump Inc. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This weekend, hundreds of thousands will hit the streets of the nation's capital to protest gun violence. Leaders of the March for Our Lives say they wish they did not have to hold this protest. Can this student movement bring about the change they want to see? And if it can, how might that happen? Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, get on out to the beautiful Jacksonville Arboretum this weekend for A Brush with Nature. This is a juried plein air painting event. I hope I pronounced that right. Here with more, Randy Pitts of First Coast Plein Air Painters. Good morning.
Good morning.
And event chair and board member, Patty Miller. Good to see you too.
Good morning. Thank you.
This is a beautiful event, Randy. The Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens is such a hidden gem on the First Coast. A Brush with Nature is just a gorgeous spring event. Can you tell us what's going to be happening and also what plein air means?
Well, plein air basically means in the open air. It's a French term, and it was coined back when the Impressionists were painting over 150 years ago. We're sort of carrying on the tradition. This event is, you're going to see about 40 artists from our group out painting on Saturday and Sunday. The artwork that they produce during the 2 days that they'll be painting will be put into a tent on exhibition, and it will be available for sale.
Right. People can buy the artwork. Patty Miller, even if you don't want to buy the artwork, you can come out and enjoy just a beautiful, beautiful gardens, beautiful artwork. It's just gorgeous.
Absolutely. And so part of this is also raising awareness for the Arboretum. We have about 3 miles of beautiful trails through trees and plant life that is all marked. So as Randy said, there will be artists throughout the Arboretum painting live that you can watch and see them paint. But you can also stroll the grounds and just take in the beauty of the Arboretum.
If you've never been to the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens, you really owe it to yourself to go. It's at 1445 Milco Road, right in the heart of the city.
Yes.
It's amazing, this
yes.
beautiful oasis. It really is just a beautiful urban woodland full of trails. There's a beautiful pond, and Brush with Nature is happening all day Saturday and Sunday.
That's
free,
right.
That's
free event.
Free, 9 to 5, both days. Come out.
Yes, and go to JacksonvilleArboretum.org for more. Come on out for A Brush with Nature this weekend. Thanks so much, Randy Pitts and Patty Miller. It's going to be a really nice, beautiful spring weekend for you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Again, that's all day Saturday and Sunday. It's free. Finally, this hour, we've got some other ideas for things going on this weekend. From Collective Con to GastroFest to Dennis Miller. Here she is to take us all around town, as she is almost all of the Thursdays. Here we welcome the Spectator to the show. Hey, good morning.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
You didn't call me the Mistress of Mayhem.
I forgot. Oh.
I know. I almost
a
feel like I'm
upon gonna... me for a clumsy lout. Here she is to take us all around the town. We welcome the Mistress of Mayhem. The Maven of
Thanks.
Mirth.
Oh,
the Spectator.com's Carrie Speckman is
Yay.
Here.
See, I was a little confused. I was
I'm
off,
sorry.
Off,
that, yes,
off
I
my
was,
game.
I was thrown off as well.
Okay, so Collective Con is at the fairgrounds. That's Friday through Sunday. It is North Florida's premier anime, comic book, sci-fi, fantasy, and pop culture event.
This is Cosplay Central.
Yes, and they're going to have lots of special guests. They have some folks from Stranger Things.
Nice.
They have.
Is Eleven going to be there?
Tommy H. and Carol.
That's not as good.
Well, I don't watch the show, so sorry.
I have a middle schooler and a high schooler, so I've watched every episode.
Well, but that's somebody that they're still on the show. They know Eleven.
Okay, so that's Friday through Sunday at the fairgrounds.
Yes.
Collective Con.
Here's something that you may be interested in. TC from Magnum P.I. will be there. That's more of our age group.
Magnum P.I.?
Yes.
Man, TC. This does span the generations.
Yes, and they have something from Game of Thrones. They have fan panels, video game tournaments. And then I am hosting the official after party on Saturday at 8. It's a cosplay 80s dance party.
And you will be wearing what?
That remains to be seen. I had an hour-long conversation with my friend Jenny yesterday on Facebook about it.
Will it be Pretty in Pink themed, perhaps?
No.
No.
It's going to be weirder than that.
People are just going to have to come out and see.
You're going to have to come out and see.
Okay, so that's Collective Con. Also coming up this weekend, it's Gastrofest at Mosh and Friendship Fountain.
One of my favorites. They've moved over to Friendship Fountain. It's going to be over at Mosh. They have so many awesome restaurants. Blue Bamboo, one of my favorites. Orsay, Jack's Diner, the German Schnitzel House. And they will have tastes. Like for between $1 and $3, so it might be more. So you can try all kinds of different restaurants. And then the VIP section, that's where it's at. It's at the Mosh. And
that's where you'll be, of course.
Obviously.
Okay. Also this weekend, it's Phoenix Rising, Saturday and Sunday. The Phoenix Rising Festival, the new Phoenix Art District. This is going to be a cool thing, too.
It is. And Bobby Kay, my guy, is doing a fashion show on Friday night, and then there's a dance party after that, and then Sunday it's a block party, family friendly, free block party with artists, and they'll be doing live murals and
that'll be fun,
all kinds of stuff.
Okay. Also this weekend, Dennis Miller coming to the Florida Theater, and then last but not least at Sunray,
favorite. Oh my gosh,
the Sleeping Giant Film Festival at Sunray Cinema.
It's 4 days, 26 films. Two of the highlights, RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary.
Oh, a documentary about her.
Which
okay.
looks awesome. And then If I Leave Here Tomorrow, a film about Leonard Skinner,
Hometown Boys.
I sat and watched every single trailer from last night. And now I got some that are at the same time as each other. I don't know what to do.
That's not a good spectator situation.
I'm going to have to say, Tim, which one will I like better?
That's a dilemma.
Yes, it's a dilemma. Oh, and also one quick thing, the Greenscape Tree Fest is on Saturday.
That's
They're doing
up
their
too.
Tree giveaway, 9 to 2, first
yes.
come, first serve.
Go
free
get
trees
your free trees. Go to the
fairgrounds.
Go to thespectator.com for more events. Have fun this weekend.
I will. Also, trivia tonight at European Street.
You social butterfly, you.
Girl's got to work.
You're the hardest working woman in show business. That's a fact. All right, 1A's up next. I'm Melissa Ross. If you're listening to the rebroadcast, music's up next. We'll be back tomorrow at 9 with our Friday roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.